After reading novels about slavery by Toni Morrison or Edward P. Jones, you might think you'd be inured to the cruelties of that period. But I'd be surprised if certain scenes in a new novel by Marlon James don't make you gasp. The novel's called The Book of Night Women, and it is beautiful and terrifying in equal parts, and sometimes funny. It's about a slave rebellion on a plantation in Jamaica, a rebellion led by a group of women who've met secretly for years. It's also a coming-of-age story about Lilith. She's an orphan whose father is Jack Wilkins, the plantation's white former overseer. In this passage, Lilith goes to speak to her father, Wilkins, who's now elderly. We want to warn you, what you'll hear contains some harsh racial language, and you might not want kids to hear it.
Lilith's life did boil down to two things, working and whipping. But Jack Wilkins make himself present one day, like he just appear out of the dust, and the whipping stop. Surely, she said to herself, sure, even now you know to stop read anything in the actions of white people. Surely. But there her two foots be, making the mind when her own mind not doing nothing. The foots stop. She tell herself, as for she would never come to this place. What would every white man having the hankering to whip her? But there she be. Jack Wilkins' house. Took your own goddamn nigger time, he say. Neither whip nor cat will teach you monkeys anything about haste. That's your tragedy. He seated on the porch, like he'd be waiting for her all this time. But that being custom from the days when he reigned over the estate. Lilith look at him, looking at her. Now he have no control over Montpelier. But he's still out on the porch every morning, looking out and waiting for him pitcher of lemonade mixed with rum, and cuss cause the wife can't make it as good as Homer. Wilkins' hat off, and the top of him head bald. Him shirt open right down to the waist, but him white chest here so bushy, it look like he got another shirt underneath. He leaning back in the chair with him foots up on the balustrade. Wilkins look like everybody know he old, save he. Lilith still. She at the foot of the step and can feel the dirt under her foot, the shadow from the step cool. She can't think of nothing to say, so she just still. Lilith forced herself to look up, but he not looking at her. Only the Almighty knows why he set me up with a woman more barren than Jesus' wilderness, he say. Instead, he gave me a litter of niggers. Guess it's my fault for not keeping my sticker in my breeches, eh? Lilith don't say nothing.
That is Marlon James reading from his new novel, The Book of Night Women. Marlon, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
So this book is filled with kind of wonderfully Baroque cursing, which I'm a fan of. The HBO program Deadwood from a few years ago, I loved partly for that very reason. Now, it's set in Jamaica in 1800. How sure are you that people talked that way and cursed that way 200 years ago?
I am pretty sure of it. In fact, their mouths are probably even more foul than ours. You know, in a country and a time when people had no reason to be polite, it may have been even more coarse.
Yeah. As you were figuring out the voices and the voice of this novel set 200 years ago in Jamaica, presumably there was very little written verbal spoken record that you could rely on, right?
Right.
So it was a leap into the imagination to figure out how people would talk.
Yeah. For example, a word that I have in my book, mayhaps, is something I just came up with. You know, why use perhaps and maybe when you can just make up mayhaps? You know, and it
my
works.
My mother used to say mayhaps, actually.
Yeah?
I was
about to patent that.
Well, my mother's dead, so it'll be okay. The estate won't mind.
You know, a friend of mine from Ghana came to Jamaica 4 years ago, and he was just stunned at how much African words were still in Jamaican dialect.
Huh.
And also, we have a pretty strong oral tradition and music tradition, so a lot of those words kept on in songs, which is why a lot of scenes in the book, the slaves are singing to Lilith. Those songs, people still sing. You know, thank God for Huckleberry Finn, because I reread it. And I just realized, you know, you have to sort of stay true to the voice that's telling you the story.
Presumably, in this case, the question you were facing was, how convincing a voice can this be? How will a reader keep with this over 300 pages? You didn't have any of the, oh, God, is it somehow wrong of me to write in this form of English, this non-standard English?
Not really. I mean, because my generation in Jamaica, we're the ones who sort of started, well, we didn't start it, but we grew up where we take something like reggae music for granted. Mm-hmm. Unlike my father's generation, they were, you know, we got ourselves educated. We were the first generation to go to college. We took elocution classes. How dare you speak in this broken English? You know, where to us, it's just the language that we've claimed. So we have no sort of shame attached to dialect.
I know that you have always been a big Toni Morrison fan, and mm-hmm. she certainly paved the way in making people who are oppressed not necessarily nice or good.
Right.
Has she been in that a kind of a guide to you?
She is. She's been a huge guide. In fact, I was prescribed Toni Morrison when I wrote my first book, and my workshop leader read it and she said, you know, you're a good writer, but you don't have a clue about women. And I thought I should then just make all my characters these Madonna meaning the saint types. And he says, no, you need to keep them crazy, have them do ridiculous, terrible things, but you have to sort of ground it in this sort of truth, this reality. And she prescribes Sula. You know, there's a scene in Sula where Nell asks Sula when she's dying, well, what do you have to show for your life? And Sula looks at her and goes, show to who? I was like, yeah. That was like my epiphany. I was like, wow, yeah, show to who?
You've also obviously spent time enjoying 18th century and 19th century, for that matter, English mm-hmm. novels who make appearances in this book.
To an extent, Book of Night Woman is also a book about books. Mm-hmm. You know, the most subversive thing, even in the midst of the whole rebellion and plotting, the most subversive thing the women are doing is teaching themselves to read. You know, and that itself, I mean, they could all be killed for it. It was, you know, in a lot of ways, just the secret contraband that you could, whether you could read or learning to write.
Right. How has the novel been received in Jamaica?
It's probably too early to say. I know when I told people I was writing it, you know, there was always this groan, not slavery again, you know, or why are you writing that? And even that wasn't as much as why are you writing a novel totally in dialect? Because there is still, and it's a very much a sort of British colonial thing where dialect is still looked upon as broken English, as if something in it needs to be repaired. And also the whole bringing back, you know, slavery to a discussion. I always say it's, you know, it's the great over-discussed, undiscussed topic. You know, that, you know, we still haven't really come to terms with it. One of the reasons, I think, is that most of the major works of fiction on slavery tend to be about American slavery. Mm-hmm. You know, which was so radically different from in Jamaica, in the British West Indies or the French West Indies.
How so? How radically different?
Well, for one, you know, in the South, even with so many slaves, I think Virginia had the most, it was still a minority in that population. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Jamaica, it would be close to like 98% slaves.
Right.
You know, every year there was a rebellion plot. There were plots to burn down Kingston. They burnt down Montego Bay twice. Unlike in the States, where a lot of these families either came over to settle or they built these, you know, places with no intentions of leaving, for, you know, the British person in Jamaica, their intention was always to leave.
Gee, it's almost like you're cutting the white slave owners in the United States some slack by comparison.
Oh, God, no. One of the things that I struggled with this novel is to make the white characters three-dimensional. Mm-hmm. And I got into fights with people. I'll be like, well, Heart of Darkness, non-white characters aren't three-dimensional, and everybody respects that book. You know, why can't I make them one-dimensional? And just sort of making, you know, is humanizing the demons, which I think is a very hard thing to do.
Because
it would have been very easy to just have slaves good, master bad. There is that temptation, you know, to sort of, you know, play it safe, be sort of politically correct with it.
You have said, and I read an interesting quote where you said, you have to do what you think is your very best work, which goes without saying and is kind of commonplace. But then you added, or at least what scares you the most.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what did you mean by that exactly?
I like writing about stuff that I feel I have no place writing. And part of it is sort of a dare. It was, you know, hard enough writing the perspective of one woman, but try nine. You know, one of my favorite scenes is a scene where seven of these women are in a room and they're all arguing.
Uh-huh.
And how can you distinguish seven different voices? They're all slaves. They have to sound different. You don't want to end up with confusion. And I get bored pretty easily. You know, my top drawer is full of books that will go nowhere. You know, I will, like, on Monday write Lilith into a corner and try to figure how to get her out the next day.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and I'm talking with Marlon James about his new novel. We'll be back in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. And my guest is the writer Marlon James. His new novel, The Book of Night Women, is about a slave rebellion in Jamaica. In this passage, the main character, Lilith, walks in on a secret meeting of the plotters led by a woman named Homer. Just a heads up, especially if you're listening with kids, this reading contains some racial epithets.
"Freedom coming before next Easter," Homer say. "What? You hear what me say? Obi a woman tell you that? True is true, B. You either liar or you fool. Massa not about to give no nigger free paper." "Who say nothing about massa, child? We're not getting free. We're taking free," Homer say. Pallas look at Lilith. Looking at Lilith say to Homer, "You sure about telling? What she going do? Tell her new friend the mistress? Mistress know you kill Johnny Jumper too? If it was up to she, the mistress would make all of them rape you and sell the young un. You just wicked cause maybe 16 and me the mistress favorite. Oh, is that you making arrangement for? You the only one who don't know say the mistress head take her all the time? You think cause she throwing party the devil don't gone with her sense? She look plenty sensible to me. Girlie, if you don't know that everything be how it look, then you not ready," Pallas say. "Homer, is long time Cersei poisoning the bitch, man. You can't just me have as much sense as you, nigga. Me find your cave, and me can show the mistress where y'all plotting." All of a sudden, the only sound in the room was a candle flicking. Every woman in the room looked upon Lilith. Gorgon get up. Callista hold her knife up by the blade and look at Lilith. Even Hippolyta come out of the shadow. Lilith gasp. "Me can fling this knife between a wild boar eye at 70 pace," Callisto say. I can run." You can try." Lilith smart mouth run out of smart. "Just because we all come from Master Jack don't mean me and you be cumbelow. Listen to yourself, you stupid child," Homer say. "You think you and white woman going be friend? You think she going make tea and cucumber sandwich and invite you to sit? Don't tell me some make big mistake and think you have sense. And you is 15, not 16.
That is Marlon James reading from his novel, The Book of Night Women, and reading the voices of several of the night women. Both of your novels are about times before you were born. Even your first novel is set in the 50s,
right,
at the end of the colonial period. Do you feel like you're done with writing about history and you're going to write something set in 2010 now?
Oh, God, yes. Actually, the book I'm writing now is set in 2080. So, yeah, I made this joke to a friend of mine. I can describe a carriage for like 10 days. You know, I can describe a spaceship. Just don't ask me to describe a Chevy. I don't know. Maybe it's because I live in the present. I just cannot describe what the interior of a car looks like. So my, you know, so I love the past, and part of it is a very Jamaican thing in a sense of just coming, reckoning with what happened in the past. My first novel, in a lot of ways, I was inspired by just going back and debunking this sort of poetry of poverty that you always used to hear in Jamaican fiction. You know, the river is always clear, there's always crayfish swimming, and people are always going to market, and everybody's singing a song, and it wasn't like that. You know, but also, you know, the book I'm working on now, I mean, it's set in 2018, and it's kind of post-apocalyptical. But the main reason I'm writing it is because, you know, I read A Clockwork Orange and loved it. And I was like, yeah, I want to make a language up.
You've mentioned reggae as as a sort of kind of cultural lodestar in terms of allowing a vernacular language and approach to the world. Do you feel as though, I mean, you were born really just as reggae was making its way into, you know, the Cambridge, Massachusettses of the world and becoming popular. Do you feel as though you are in the slipstream of that?
Yeah, definitely. Certainly in the sense that I've never had an American publisher, an American editor, anybody ask me to supply a glossary. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'd have to think that it must be this sort of, you know, cultural assimilation of reggae. It's every frat kid having a copy of Bob Marley Legend in their dorm room.
Yes.
But also, you know, there was a time, especially in the 70s, when reggae singers, reggae artists were the only ones speaking truth to power. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the only ones calling the system bad and calling up politicians for how they are, you know, they have sort of pillaged and plundered, you know, the country. And in a lot of ways, the Bob Marleys and the Peter Tosh, they took the hit, you know, that so that people like me can write about stuff and don't have to worry about it, don't have to worry about consequences. They came out first. They were the first fearless chroniclers of the Jamaican condition, and you know, they paid the price for it.
You've written a lot about music. You've been a music critic. And interestingly, it's not as though at all that you seem to write mainly about or love mainly reggae music or Caribbean music at all. You're an eclectic guy. In your
interests, yeah. The thing about reggae and Caribbean music, you know, is that I grew up with it. You know, it's I was saying to someone before, you know, it's like a family member. Just because I know everything doesn't mean I want to see them all the time. But my real sort of eureka moment was listening to rock and roll. You know, in Jamaica in high school, everybody has to do watch this documentary, American documentary called Highway to Hell, and which is about Satanism in rock and roll and bat masking and all of that. And everybody else was freaking out and in tears about how they have been deceived by the devil. I was taking notes. I was like, AC/DC, oh my God. You know, Wasp, Slayer, let's get all of that. Led Zeppelin. And you know, and so, you know, I grew up listening to a lot of that. Lots and lots of 80s indie rock, like Husker Du and Replacements and Minutemen and Sonic Youth and all of that. You know, and it was very weird when being a music critic, writing about those things, knowing nobody in Jamaica knows who Husker Du is.
And I'm told, I've read, that you actually listen to rock and roll and music with lyrics as you're writing.
Yeah.
Which astonishes me.
Like, when I was writing my first novel, I was listening to Bjork a lot. There's a line in one of her songs, she was like, I tried to organize freedom, how Scandinavian of me. And when you're writing, you read that differently. You just think of people who keep trying to sort of put order in lives that are essentially chaotic. You know, so it's always that. It's also the fearlessness of hearing what's going on and what they're saying, and just reminding me, you know, I can't have taboos in my own work. You know, and that I guess is the way in which it stirs me. I really do not write in silence. I respect everybody who does, but I just get crazy if it's quiet.
Yeah. You blog a lot, and one of your posts was about the anti-intellectualism that you find in the African American community, and it was very frank on that subject. And I wonder if you had gotten heat for that.
Oh, I always get heat.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, there is, there, you know, it was something that continues to be an argument in different ways. Black literary fiction writers getting huge arguments with black commercial fiction writers, you know, about what I'm talking about, you know, you not elevating the art in any way, or you're reinforcing the stereotype of what black fiction should be. It's always the hotshot music and the executive who's just searching for real love in the big city, mm-hmm. you know, or it's, you know, this sort of hope, very, very sort of intellectual snobbish fiction written by graduates of Columbia or whatever. That one, again, like most of my articles, was inspired by music, about the whole expectations behind an artist like D'Angelo, who does not fit into formula. And also, you know, writers as well who do not write something that may be on, you know, I mean, not star Madea or whoever. You know, where do these writers end up?
By Madea, you mean Tyler Perry?
Yeah,
not the figure of antiquity.
No, yeah, you know, but it is a problem. I have been to stores, none of which I will name, where they will tell me, you know, it may be kind of a hard sell, you know, you being, you know, a literary fiction writer. I was like, you know, maybe I should create another identity, call myself, like, you know, Hector Buddy Love, and write, you know, and write, like, you know, Hot in Harlem, and, you know, do some stuff like that.
Marlon James, I want to thank you very much. This was a pleasure.
Thank you. It was great being here.
Marlon James's new novel, The Book of Night Women, is out now.